Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7, Lecture 12. This is Artifacts. And before we get into Artifacts, I figured it's good to do just a quick review of some of the information that we went over last week regarding color. So as you recall, color perception for us, it's not difficult, but how we perceive color is not absolute. It's not completely true. And as you recall, I showed some optical illusions to try to demonstrate this fact. And if you remember, in this case, we had this optical illusion where the tiles A and B are actually the same color, but because of the way that we perceive color, we do not actually see those two as being equal. Let's see, on the printed slides, and now on here, I've shown that I've just drawn a color bar that's the same color and just stretches from A to B, and this helps convince you a little bit better that the two colors are indeed the same. And if you remember last week, we actually brought out a color meter to actually measure the values of both, and so that you could actually see that the value of A, the color value of A, matches that of color B. Yeah, it does depend also on how you look at it. If you squint a little bit, or if you try to look beyond it, much like you would with those magic eye puzzles, if you know what I mean, the ones where you have to look beyond the image to try to see the sub-image in it, then if you try to trick your eyes in that way, then you can actually see that it's the same color. But you have to know to do that, and when you're just looking at an image, even though that image may not have this like a replicated version of this exact optical illusion, this is just used to demonstrate that we do have to be careful of the colors that we produce on a computer, because we have to be sure that they are exact. And so in order to replicate color accuracy on a computer, we can't just trust our eyes to look at an image and completely understand what is wrong with that image color-wise. Like, we can't look at it and say, oh, my monitor looks like it's perhaps a little bit too dark or a little bit too gray or green or something like that. If it's drastically different, you might notice, but we do have to be sure to perform some steps to make sure that it is exactly right. And so in order to do that, we have to deal with color management. And a portion of color management is the idea of color spaces, where we have, of the entire set of colors that we can see, there's actually a subset that is defined by color spaces that a computer uses to know what colors it can represent. So each value in a photo each color might have a specific value associated with it, and if the computer knows what color space that value is, then it can try to replicate exactly that color in real life as we would have expected to see it when we actually were there to take the photo as well. And so we mentioned a couple of color spaces, and there's two of the big ones that we mentioned, sRGB and Adobe RGB, and the one that you really should use for general use, for using it on the internet, email, etc., is sRGB. Adobe RGB really is only useful if you're going to be doing a lot of changes on your own, or perhaps going to be printing them out or doing some sort of professional printing with that particular image. So we do run into this problem from time to time where we have to change color spaces. So maybe you accidentally saved your Photoshop image in Adobe RGB, and then you have to change it to sRGB so that you can display it on the internet. And you have a couple of choices, remember, and these are called gamut mapping, when you actually convert from one color space to another. You can do a perceptual color change, or perceptual color space change, or a colorimetric color space change. And the one that we generally want to use as photographers is the perceptual one, because it maintains the gradients without throwing away certain values of color that we might with colorimetric gamut mappings. And so if we are talking about color spaces, then we also have to talk about making sure that our monitors and that our printers actually reproduce the colors that we expect them to. And this comes, and from this we get the idea of profiling our monitors, where You can do this in software, or sometimes the best way to do it is with a hardware little puck device, or a little device that hangs over your monitor or connects to your monitor in some way and actually reads the actual colors that your monitor can display. And using this information, your computer can then figure out, okay, well, in order to show a red, a color red that I think should look like this, I have to tell the monitor this signal. And then your monitor would then be able to accurately display the various colors that exist within a color space, assuming that your monitor can actually display all of the colors in a color space. And just a quick note, remember that the color spaces are actually relatively small compared to what we can see. Most high-end monitors can actually capture a lot of the colors that we can perceive, but still not everything. And so particularly laptop monitors or laptop screens are pretty bad at this. They have a much smaller range of colors that they can actually produce than some of the higher-end monitors can. And so if you're very serious about taking some photographs and selling them professionally, then you really should consider not modifying them on your laptop screen, or even if you have one of those glossy screens. That seems to be a fad nowadays. Or all of these screens that have this sort of mirror finish about them, that can actually falsely increase the contrast on some of your images. And if you were to look at that same image on a matte screen, it may look different. And so, though you could be able to profile that monitor so that you're sure that you get it absolutely correct, you still have the problem of reflecting light, actually modifying that color. So many people will swear by using matte screens or the non-glossy screens in a professional setting just so that you're sure to get the best color reproduction. And there's a variety of monitors out there that are very good. You'd have to do your research and determine which ones are the best. But if you get a good monitor, you can be sure that you'll get very good color, very accurate color out of it at least. And so when our cameras take a photo, they do it and they have to set a white balance, because what we perceive as being color in a scene, the camera might view those colors in a very different light, so to speak. And so for example, as the sun sets in the evening, the light gets a bit warmer, or what we call as warmer, where the tones get slightly more orange and slightly more red, which looks much more appealing. It actually means that we are decreasing the color temperature. So as the color temperature value itself, as the number actually goes down, those represent tones that are a bit warmer than the higher Kelvin tones. And we have to make this adjustment because this is the only way that a camera would know, or that a computer would know or can show you that photo accurately as we would perceive that scene. Because as part of this, as part of our vision, our eyes adapt to the given lighting conditions, and a white sheet of paper for us, for example, still appears to be white, even if we change it from this room, which is fluorescent, and if we were to go outside where the sun is setting, then we would the value would actually be different, but it still appears white to us. And so I used all of this information as an argument, again, for using RAW on your cameras, because using RAW files, you have greater bit depth. You can apply a tonal curve yourself. If one is not applied for you by your computer, you can set the white balance, and this is usually the best, or at least the most accurate way of setting the white balance. If you don't set a custom white balance in your camera by taking a picture of a gray card or of a neutral white sheet of paper, even and setting the custom white balance to that, then you might have to go back later and readjust the white balance in your RAW processor. Of course, using RAW also, it's a much bigger file, but it's not lossy compressed, which means that you still have all of the original data out of the camera, and you can do everything you want with that particular data. However, of course, the downside is then that it is a larger file that you have to deal with, so you can take fewer photos on your memory card, you can store fewer photos on your machine, but also you have to process that file once you bring it onto your computer. And whether that actually involves clicking a few buttons and saving it as a JPEG, it's still a bit more work than actually just downloading a JPEG and working with that straight off of the camera. Any questions? Okay, so artifacts. We've alluded to and spoken about certain types of artifacts up in the past, but we've really done a lot of hand-waving and didn't talk about some of the details about what they look like, how it can happen, and what we can do to fix it. And there's a variety of types of artifacts that we see. There's optical artifacts that are the result of the light actually traveling through the lens and moving through all of the lens groups and optics that exist within the camera. And then there's also these electronic artifacts that can happen as a result of maybe, as an example, this demosaic filter or this demosaic algorithm that the camera actually performs on this bare filter data in order to recombine all of the colors back to their original colors. And so first we'll focus on these optical artifacts, or what are also known as optical aberrations. It's a different word for the same thing. And many times online you'll see people talking about aberrations. They're really just talking about these artifacts. And so remember from many lectures ago, we talked about lenses and what lenses are and what makes them up, and realize that or recall that lens is not usually just one piece of glass, even though it's used, even though some people refer to lenses as being glass, it's not just one piece of glass that focuses the light. There's usually many pieces of glass within it that help to focus and correct the light as it comes in. And actually, I figured that now would be a very good time to show you the video that I was unable to show you last time. This was a link to it was shown on the forum, but this is, I think, very interesting and something worthwhile to show. And this is if you remember that How It's Made video on CCD semiconductors, where they basically showed us how sensors were made, we are going to show you now how lenses are made.
These television lenses start with a very precise design. A diamond blade slices up a block of specially selected optical glass, while coolant prevents the blade from burning it. The slices then go under a diamond drill, which cuts several puck-sized discs from one glass slice. The operator is careful to keep waste to a minimum. Optical glass costs up to $1,000 per kilogram. The optical glass sits on a thinner piece of glass covered with wax. As the wax is melted, the discs are easily pulled away. Next, a device spins one of the discs while a wheel overhead sculpts it into a lens. Checks each lens for chips, and this one looks smooth. This tar-like substance is called pitch. The edges of the lenses have been built up with tape to contain the pitch. They completely coat the underside of the lens with it. Several pitch-covered lenses are now in a metal shell. A worker picks up a hot aluminum dome called a blocking body. He presses it onto the pitch-covered lenses, and the pitch melts onto it. Dousing it with water causes the pitch to harden, sealing the lenses to the blocking body. The blocking body is now upside down and acting as a holding device as it oscillates on a spinning grinding shell. The grinding makes the surface of the lenses uniform and smooth. They place a polisher on the lenses. It's lubricated with a very fine abrasive. For about an hour, the polisher oscillates while the block spins. Polishing makes the lenses smooth and transparent. It also gives them an even more curved profile. The lenses have been removed from the block, and it's time to cut the diameter down to size. Using a microscope, a technician centers a lens between two brass chucks. The diamond blade at the back cuts the lens as the technician monitors it. He's making sure the diameter and axis of the lens have a common center. Next, they group some lenses on round racks called planets. Their universe is a vacuum chamber. Closes the door, and the planets continue their orbit. Inside this vacuum, an electron beam evaporates coating materials. The vapor rises to give the lenses a protective coat. A computer monitors the rate of evaporation and the coating. But there's much more to come. Up next, this process really gets visual as all the pieces of the camera lens come together. Just spent 3 hours getting a protective finish. It's time to wipe away any residue and make sure they're perfect. This particular lens is concave. She covers it to protect it while she cleans and inspects a lens with the opposite profile, convex. Lens goes to another technician who places it in a holding device. He looks into a microscope and adjusts the position of the lens until it's optically centered. He uses wax to keep the lens from shifting in the holding device. They give the lens another cleaning. Each one must be absolutely spotless before they proceed to the next step. Otherwise, dust particles could become trapped within the optical system and affect image quality. Now that the surface of the convex lens is immaculate, she dabs optical cement onto the center of it. She gives the other concave lens a little more scrutiny before she cements it onto the convex lens. She applies pressure to spread the cement between the two lenses. Cementing them together means they'll be less likely to shift around in the lens barrel. She checks for dust one more time. Then it's under the microscope for an optical alignment of this double lens. Because the cement isn't yet dry, he can push the top lens around and adjust its position. They prep the barrel that will hold the lenses. A technician traces out lettering using a stylus, attached to a sharp tool that engraves information onto the lens barrel. It prints technical details that will tell the photographer just what the lens will do, things like focal length, the F-number, and the size of the aperture opening. These reference points allow the user to pull a picture into focus at the desired magnification. outlines of this complex optical system and begin to pull all the pieces together. This singlet, or single lens, goes into the metal barrel first. Other lenses with various curvatures and dimensions follow. She places metal spacers between the lenses to separate them. Proper spacing will prevent aberrations in the image, such as blurring. Lint-free plastic, because eliminating dust continues to be a necessity. One fleck could ruin this entire assembly. Using tweezers, she coaxes the last lens into the barrel. She installs a retaining ring to hold the stack of lenses down. Then she locks it into place. There's one final inspection. She examines the assembled optical lens from all angles. It takes a total of 6 weeks to make one of these optical lenses, and in the end, it's picture perfect.
Okay, so as you can see, what's most interesting to me, and what hopefully is a little bit more apparent to you now, is just how much people are still involved in this process. There's still a lot of hard work going into these. They're not completely automated yet. And because of that, even though they are taking all of these steps to correct these lenses, there's still things that can go wrong. I mean, obviously, things can go wrong in an automated process as well, but still, there's a number of things, like all of this big dust problem that they keep alluding to, that they keep referring to. This is actually a very big concern, and even now, there are many lenses, if not all lenses, continue to be hand built, especially some of these very large, very expensive ones. They have special teams of optically certified folks that work hard on making all of these lenses as exact and as precise as possible. And so they mentioned a number of things that are pretty interesting. They did mention, of course, the aberrations, where they have to be absolutely sure that everything is exact and precise, so that there's no aberrations within the image. But even if a lens is built perfectly, there still could be problems with the design itself that could cause particular types of aberrations. And this isn't like modern electronic technology, where as we move on in time, things like transistors and sensors tend to get smaller and better at a reliable rate. This is actually a much slower process. And while we have had advances in optical technology, we still have some very real problems in current lens technology. So, for example, and the first one that I want to mention is what's called a spherical aberration. And so this is when a lens is formed in such a way that its face is essentially like one part of a very large sphere. And when that portion of the sphere is focusing light down to a point, so if this light is coming in from a point source way over here in the far end, and it's refocusing the light so that it's all coming down, instead of putting it all on one very sharp point like it was originally, as is shown here, a spherical lens will actually cause this light to be focused at different points within this optical axis. And so we have here a variety of points where this light is converging into one point. And so this can result in a number of things, but normally, one of the things that you would see as a result of this is just softness in the image itself. And the only time that you could really identify it as being spherical, perhaps, versus many other types of aberrations that can cause softness, is actually to take a look at a photo of it from a point source. And so if you see it like this, you typically see it in almost a halo-like fashion. I have a a couple of, let's see, so I have here a couple of examples that I can show you of spherical aberrations. And basically what you will see is that instead of a pure point being obviously this website has an error on it. I'll show you on another, here we go. So this is for a specific type of technology, but still it shows us a very good point, and so or a good example of what can happen with spherical aberrations. So on the left, for example, we have just a point source, and if it was perfectly reproduced, it would look like that point on film or on your sensor. However, what can happen in spherical aberrations is that you get this sort of soft halo effect that can occur around this point. But most of the time, you don't have just very sharp, very precise points in your image, unless you're doing astrophotography, and you might have, for example, more complex images, so something like this very large E, which might become softer because of spherical aberrations. And so there is a way that makers of lenses can actually fix this, and this is using what are called aspherical elements. And these are elements that are not necessarily spherical, but are more hyperbolic in shape. So they're a little bit flatter on the very outside, for example, and this actually allows all of the light to be focused properly within the lens. But for all of these aberrations, the further you are from the center of a lens, the more obvious these aberrations are going to be. So right now, this is a very extreme example, and it's showing you what happens when a point source is in the center of the focal plane. But where you'll normally see all of these problems is in the very corner of your particular image. And also, if you're using a lens that has a very large aperture, very wide aperture, a lot of these problems can become much more easily apparent. Okay. So there's another type of optical aberration called a coma. And in this one, it actually causes a shape that looks very much like a comet. And the result of this comes from light that is slightly off-axis and comes in at an angle. And what happens here is that the light is, again, not perfectly converged at one point like it should be on the film, but you'll get this weird sort of cone-shaped or comet-shaped appearance. And so here's another example of where we can get this. So, for example, if we have light that's coming in from down here going through a particular lens, in the very center, it will actually appear to be... So as the light travels through the center, rather, it'll appear to be sharp and one point. But as the light from outside of the center, so as we expand out of the center of the lens and that light comes in, because remember, light doesn't come from just one point source and straight through. It sort of spreads out. And so every portion of this lens will see that point source of light. As it spreads out, we actually get further and further down this axis. And so to give you an idea or a real-world example of what this looks like, there's an image here of just some streetlight. So it's obviously very underexposed, but it demonstrates this point very, very well, where if we look at the very center of the image, where it's reasonably well corrected, but also this problem just does not happen because it's right in the center of the axis. If we take a look at that yellow box up here, we can see that these sources of light or these streetlights are actually very circular, very, very spherical, as we would expect them to be. But as we move outside, sideways from the center of this image, we get this strange comet-like appearance of these lights. So these lights here should not appear to be like comets, but they are because of the way that this lens in particular is designed. And so if you see something like this, then you know that your lens is not very well corrected for this particular type of aberration or comas. So there are, of course, other optical aberrations as well. So astigmatism may be familiar to those of you who, like me, have less than perfect vision. So I mask this very well by wearing contacts all the time. But one of my eyes, my left eye in particular, is astigmatic, which all it means is that if you have some shape that you're looking at or that your lens is trying to capture an image of, it actually distorts the shape in some way. So as an example, a sphere. So what might be a perfect sphere for an astigmatic eye or for an astigmatic lens, it'll actually be elongated in some way. So it'll look more like an ellipse or an oval rather than being perfectly round. And this is certainly another big problem. You want your lens to be able to reproduce all of the geometric shapes precisely and well without having to worry about correcting it at some later point. A lot of these optical aberrations are actually very, very difficult to correct in software. There's a lot of specialized software out there that can help correct for it. But in general, it's usually a result of the lens. And so in order to fix it, you usually have to get a new lens. Maybe not the exact same one, because it's most likely will cause the same problem. But you might have to get, unfortunately, a more expensive lens. Most of these, though, also, don't be too scared off by a lot of these things. Most of these things are a little bit more difficult to pinpoint in real-world situations unless the problem is very, very visible, or you're taking a particular type of photograph that is very suited to seeing these types of aberrations. So in any sort of photograph where you have very distinct geometric shapes and you see this elongation of them, especially off the center of the axis, so slightly down from the center or to the left or to the right, for example, and you see maybe a circle being elongated to an oval or something like that, then you are most likely seeing an astigmatism in the lens. Okay, so this one you're perhaps all familiar with. It's called a vignette, and this is an actual optical aberration because something within the optics is causing an actual change to the amount of light that's coming in. And so remember that lenses are not rectangular objects. They're all circular. And sometimes maybe the aperture or the F number is too low for the actual size of the lens, or maybe we have something that's actually blocking out corners of the light. But if you have a vignette, it looks like this, where your lens or your image, rather than being rectangular, now looks slightly circular. And so usually we'll see this with poorly designed lens hoods. And lens hoods are the things that you put on in the front of your lens in order to shade it from sunlight being down at strange angles and getting weird artifacts as a result of that. This one in particular is probably, so I didn't take this photo, but in this case, a lens hood is most likely not going to create something this bad. This is probably some actual problem within the lens itself that is causing a vignette that is like this. And so we can have a variety of types of vignettes. And so we can have mechanical ones, optical, or just natural vignettes that can occur. And a lot of people like to introduce a very soft amount of vignetting into their image because it's sort of indicative of older photographs. A lot of older photographs did actually exhibit this sort of problem, not to this degree where the corners are actually black, but any time that you see the corners of the image becoming darker than the center, and a surprising number of cameras will actually do this to a very slight degree, then you are experiencing some vignette. And so I gave the example of the lens hood just a second ago, but there is another type of vignette that can occur, particularly with very large aperture lenses, and that is this particular type of optical vignette. So let's say that we have this particular lens that is at one point or an f1.4, so it has a very, very low F number, which means very big aperture. And so if we take a look straight through the center of that lens, we can then see everything behind that lens, which is in this first photo up here. But now let's say that we look at that lens slightly off-center. We can see that as we turn it off-center, we actually are blocking some of the circle that is produced behind it. So rather than seeing through the entire lens, we're actually only able to see a little bit of the background behind it. And you'll notice that on the right side, on the right column here, that doesn't happen when we've stopped the lens down. So for much smaller apertures or F numbers that are a bit higher, We don't typically see this as being a problem because the aperture is much smaller, so even if we turn the lens slightly, we can still see the entire aperture as a result. So if you have a very large lens that has this sort of optical vignette, then one of the solutions to do would be to stop it down. Obviously, you then lose some of the capabilities of this very wide aperture lens, but you have to make a trade-off. Which do you want, the vignette or the wide aperture? And so this optical vignette can cause another type of problem. Rather than actually seeing a vignette in the corner, we can have this type of image where the corners are already very dark, so we can't really maybe notice any sort of corner vignetting going on. But what we see in this type of vignette is the background blur. It's not perfectly circular. And so if we take a look at these candles, so these can essentially be considered as point sources of light. And as we defocus these, they should just become very soft circles of light. But instead, we get this sort of cat eye shaped, where it's squished. And the reason for this is because these lights are off to the side of this lens. And so it's exactly as if that light is trying to come through this side here. Part of it is getting blocked off by this very large aperture lens that we have. And so we get this sort of cat-like or cat-eye-like shaped. And so you might see a reference to this on some forums or in a variety of places. If you see something like this, then you have this cat's eye optical aberration that can be caused. And so then the solution to this would be to do what? Yeah, stop down a little bit, exactly. And so as we then increase the F number a bit, we decrease the aperture, we're not going to see that same problem because we've stopped down sufficiently that vignette does not actually happen. Okay. Any questions so far? All right, so what we've talked about then are mechanical vignettes with like there's some actual object blocking the light, like a lens hood, for example. An optical vignette where we have actually because of the shape of the lens or whatever reason within the lens, we're actually blocking the light here. So this is an optical vignette. There's also a natural vignette as well, which can occur because of light fall off. Remember this idea that we have of where the inverse square law, so that as light has to travel further, it spreads more and so it becomes less illuminated. Well, in very, very wide lenses, for example, here, we could have some of that happening where we have a very small distance from the center of the lens to here, but we have a much larger distance from this part of the lens to the edge of the frame there. And so we could get this sort of natural vignette where because light has to travel a bit farther, we have this inverse square law where there's actually a little bit less illumination. And so it's not enough that would cause this sort of black and white vignette that we have here, where all of a sudden you see a very properly exposed scene and then just bam, all of a sudden it goes completely dark. It's just going to be very much more natural, I suppose you can say. It's just going to fall off much more smoothly, and it's not even going to look like this where you have this sort of cat's eye result. And so remember that another thing, this actually is a good demonstration of what I was talking about before when we're talking about micro lenses, how these micro lenses have to get the light that's traveling at a very oblique angle and bring it down into that well, because remember there's the photosensor well where the sensor's at the bottom and the light has to go down into it within all the electronics to actually be recognized. You'll notice that here, especially in this wide angle lens where the focal length is very, very small, here the light is coming at a very sharp angle, particularly to the edges of the sensor. And this gives you a good idea of why these micro lenses are necessary, so that this light can then be focused down into the well and recorded by the sensor. Okay, so there's a couple more optical aberrations, and this one in particular is probably very recognizable to those of you with consumer uh, or not uh, not consumer specifically, but rather digital or digicams, or just the small compact cameras that have the lenses built in. Usually these are not very well corrected for this particular type of optical aberration, where we have some sort of distortion in the shape, where we have an original object, and this is different than an astigmatism, where it's actually elongating. Let's say it's elongating the circle, for example. This is as if it's wrapping the image around, let's say, a barrel. So let's say you were to print out this photo, and you put it on the side of the barrel, and you know how it would then look somewhat curved. That's one type of distortion, or it could be the inverse of that. And so we have this idea of barrel-shaped distortion and cushion-shaped distortion, where it looks like it's popping out at you a little bit, as if it's wrapped around a barrel, or it's as if it were on a cushion, and the cushion were sort of concave, if it were falling in within it. And so typically the way that we see this is on these compact digital cameras that have the very high optical zoom lenses, so that go from very, very wide to very, very, very telephoto, where what we normally see is the wide-angle side of these lenses have a barrel-shaped distortion, and the very far telephoto edge usually have pincushion distortion. And so this is different, though, than this perspective change that we get because of wide-angle distortion. This is actually an optical distortion that is caused by that, rather than a physical distortion that happens because of the way that we are capturing, or the amount of light that we are capturing. And this is actually an optical vignette that is, or not an, not a vignette, I'm sorry, an optical distortion or an optical aberration that is somewhat easily corrected in software, because you know how your lens will react, or you can measure how your lens will react at various focal lengths and be able to apply the same correction to every photo at that particular focal length. And so to give you an example, we have here a barrel and pin cushion distortion. On the left we have barrel, and notice that this window should be rectangular, but instead what we see is sort of bulge in the side. It's bulging outwards, as if we've kind of curved this shape outward a little bit. And on the right we have pin cushion distortion. And again, this building should be very, very straight, but what you see particularly on the outside edges here is that it actually bends inward a little bit. And so this is a barrel and pin cushion distortion that you might normally see in a compact digital camera, and you would want to correct. The barrel one is especially noticeable in this case, but it depends on your particular lens and on your particular camera to determine how much barrel or pin cushion distortion you might actually have. Okay, any questions so far? All right, so we can also have optical artifacts that deal with more than just the actual image itself. It can deal with the color, which is a much more basic element within the images. And so just as an example, if you remember from grade school when you first learned the magic of prisms, where you would just shine some sunlight through a prism and it would break it up into its constituent parts, and you would see essentially a rainbow on the table right next to the prism. Remember that the reason that we saw this artifact or this event happening was because the light or the color that travels at different wavelengths is bent through the prism at different angles. And so as the light comes in at a particular angle, the light refracts or the light bends depending on how much energy it has, and then it's broken up into its constituent parts. And so we have the original white light coming in, and then what we see as a result is this breakup in color. And so this happens in more than just prisms. This happens also in lenses. And so another example that you might think of is, let's say, a straw in water. So if you have a straw in water, it looks broken or it looks bent in some way, and that's because the light that travels through the water is traveling at it gets refracted because it travels at a different speed within the water than it does in the air. And so it breaks the light to a certain degree, and you see this sort of optical change within it. And so as the light changes speed, because as it moves through these various mediums, the light changes speed. And so this change in speed actually affects where each of these wavelengths will be going in terms of in terms of their color. And so we can get then aberrations due to color, which are called chromatic aberrations. So in uncorrected lenses, we could have different colors focus at different points. So for example, here, let's just say that we have just some generic lens and light, white light is coming through and focusing onto a focal plane, this big line here. Now you'll notice that in this case, because all of these colors are traveling at different speeds and so they refract differently through this glass-air interface, what happens is that we get the green light actually focuses very well here, but the red or the blue light doesn't. The blue light seems to focus before the focal plane, and so it gets slightly blurry after it reaches it. And the red light does the same thing, except after. It focuses after the focal plane, so it's just not going to be perfectly sharp on the sensor itself. And another place that we might see this is, of course, in the case of being off-center. The light might be coming slightly off-center here, and then we could get this sort of strange chromatic aberration where it all focuses on the focal plane, but they focus on different points. So the blue focuses slightly off-center from the red or the green. And so what we can see is this really strange sort of colorful distortion that can occur within photographs. And so we have here an image of a building, but because of chromatic aberrations, we can actually see a change in some of these colors. So for example, up here, it looks a little bit more blue up here versus sort of red underneath and to the left. And you can see that throughout this particular image. Okay, so what do you think might happen if we weren't taking a color photograph? What if we were taking a black and white photograph? How might this image appear?
Blurry.
Blurry, right. So it's the same problem that we've been talking about for a number of other types of aberrations where this can actually cause blur, but this is doing it on a color scale rather than on some sort of geometric scale that we were talking about before. So another way to think of this is that for uncorrected images, every wavelength, so every different color, basically has a different focal length or a different focus point. And so we'd actually have to move the focus point for each of these different types of colors in order to focus them properly. And now there's a variety of ways that lens manufacturers try to correct for this. They try to use specific types of lenses or special optical coatings that try to decrease the change in speed or maybe reverse the change in speed. But it really depends on the manufacturer. For example, Canon uses what it likes to call this fluorite material that it says really helps with these chromatic aberrations, and which it generally does, but it's also very expensive to have these fluorite lenses within a lens group. Okay, so another type of chromatic aberration that we might see and that is pretty prevalent is fringing or purple fringing. And this is slightly different than a chromatic aberration where all of the colors are being changed, because in a fringing we're seeing mainly one type of color that's shifting off. And so in this case you can see sort of purple fringing around the top of the horse's mane and hair and ear. And where you will typically see this situation is in consumer-grade lenses or consumer-grade cameras that are in very backlit situations. So the ones that you might really see this are when you're taking a photo outside. The sun is maybe setting behind some trees and you take a photo and now all of a sudden you see these trees have this very harsh purple border around them. That is this purple fringing that we are talking about. And it's generally a result of one of several things. And unfortunately, it's not just one thing that we can blame it on. One could be that it is a relatively poor lens that we put on the camera. And this is most probably true if you have an SLR, for example. In an SLR camera, usually the camera itself is very high quality, but maybe you're putting a less capable lens in front of it, and so then you see purple fringing as a result. Consumer-grade cameras, however, the purple fringing might come not only from the lens, but maybe instead of or in addition to the micro lenses themselves. Because remember that the most prevalent color for us, and and also for the camera to be able to record is the green wavelength. So everything that's green, the camera has to really try to get correctly. And so the micro lenses might be optimized then for this green wavelength. And so remember that for a particular lens, different wavelengths will focus at different points. So if it's optimized for green, then that means that red and blue are not optimized for some of these micro lenses. And so then we might get this incorrect focus for red and for blue, and we might get some sort of purple fringing or some sort of fringing involved with it. So in order to fix this, again, we have to use some of these higher tech types of lenses that have maybe fluorite or some of these other chromatic aberration corrections that are built into them. Or another thing that we can do is to stop down as usual. So we can try to use a higher F number and try to decrease the amount of incidence or amount of light that's coming in at harsh oblique angles. And you might, it's amazing actually, stopping down fixes quite a few problems that exist with lenses. When you use a lens wide open, you're going to get as many problems. You're going to see all of the problems that lens has. But as soon as you stop it down a bit, so you increase the F number a few stops, then you will quickly get a lot of those problems to disappear. Okay, so is there any way that we can correct a lot of these problems? Spherical aberration, coma, any of these things that can actually happen? And yes, of course, I mentioned stopping down. So if you want to correct a lot of these problems and you don't want to foot the bill for a very expensive lens, increase the F number. Usually the sweet spot for lenses is about F8 or F11 or one of the two or around there. So if you stop down your lens to about F8 or F11, even if it's a relatively inexpensive lens, one that you can see optical aberrations in it, then usually you will get the best quality out of that lens and you might be able to make that lens or make the photo appear very pristine or very, very good. And you also want to try to, if you're really concerned about this, make sure that you're centering your object in the middle, because that's where you'll get the fewest artifacts. So maybe you can center and then recrop later. If you have a lot of artifacts on the outside or the corners, this is usually only relevant to those of you running full-frame SLRs, where the lenses are large and the corner of the full-frame images are actually showing you all of the problems from that particular lens. So basically, the general rule here is to stop down and try to avoid difficult situations in the corners. So try to avoid backlit situations in the corners or other point sources or background blur or anything. Just try to avoid everything in the corners if you are getting a lot of optical aberrations. Okay, let's take a quick 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about artifacts. Okay, hello everyone, welcome back. So before I was talking about some of the ways to fix some of these aberrations that we can get and how we can actually replicate the quality of some much more expensive, some much more expensive lenses that we can with our inexpensive lenses by stopping down to a reasonable level and also later on in Photoshop, maybe increasing the contrast and saturation and fixing some of these aberrations that we have. But there is a problem with stopping down. If you stop down too much, you get this problem that we have alluded to before, called diffraction. And so many of us have seen diffraction maybe in high school level physics or maybe even college level physics, where we have waves of light that come in and as they travel through some particular aperture or something that's some hole in a wall, and for lack of a better term, right in the middle, the light actually will fan out in this wave pattern, and we actually get some. So rather than getting the exact replica of this wave pattern behind this particular aperture, we get not only that wave pattern, but also you'll notice that there are some gray areas where that wave has actually somewhat disappeared, or it's dissipated in a way. And this is much more obvious when we are actually talking about digital or not digital, but optical apertures, rather than having something like this where you can actually go home and in your bathtub or in your sink, you can actually create some waves and obstruct the waves in this way, and you can actually replicate the same diffraction behavior. But light also does this as well. So anything that is a wave diffracts around an obstruction, around some particular aperture, and it causes an interesting pattern. And so we get these phase shifts or these strange patterns that can happen. And so if we shine a laser, for example, which is just a point source of light through a very small aperture, rather than getting at the other end of that aperture an exact replica or just a dot, an exact replica of that laser light, we get, again, this sort of halo pattern that can happen. So we get that exact pattern, and then we get around it just a halo around that, and then a halo around that, and so on and so forth. And if you were to take a look at this this image on a computer monitor rather than on here, which increases the contrast by quite a bit, you can actually see there's quite a few halos surrounding or expanding in size in these concentric circles. And so the result of this, of course, is that we get extreme softness when we are talking about very, very small apertures. So whereas in this photo on the left, we have an aperture or an F number of F5.6. If we decrease the aperture to be really, really small to, say, F45, now we get this softness. So rather than this problem that we were talking, or rather than it being sharper, as you might expect, because now we are able to get more in focus, what's happening is that, yes, the depth of focus has increased a lot, so we are getting more in focus, but this diffraction problem comes into play, and so now things are becoming very, very soft. So this isn't an out-of-focus problem. This is a diffraction problem. It's an actual limitation, a physical limitation due to the properties of light. And this was a question that I gave on an early-on assignment about the little pinhole photo, if you remember. Remember that it was very, very blurry, and I said that it's not just blurry because of motion blur, but it was blurry for some other reason, and the reason is this diffraction. It's a very, very small pinhole, and the light is diffracting around it and becoming very, very soft, even though the aperture is small enough. It was something like, what, F256 or 128 or something like that. It was small enough that essentially everything within the frame should have been in focus. So it wasn't an out-of-focus problem, it was a diffraction problem. And so we see this not only in digital SLRs, where we can get F numbers to be this large, but we see this also in consumer digital cameras. However, in those cases, the manufacturers seem to be doing that thing where they're protecting the consumer from themselves by limiting the actual highest F number that you can achieve on that consumer camera. So many of you I mean compact cameras, because they're actually much smaller and their apertures are therefore much smaller. It's the actual physical size of the aperture that matters. And so since those are already much smaller, you can't get a much smaller aperture without getting all of these diffraction problems. And so they limit the highest F number that you can achieve in this, most likely because of this diffraction problem, where if consumers were or purchasers of these compact digital cameras who didn't know about this particular type of artifact or aberration, just started increasing the F number and noticed, well, it should be getting sharper, but now it's getting much, much blurrier. Something must be wrong with my camera. There's nothing wrong with your camera. It's just the limitation of that. And so the manufacturers presumably just try to limit that from happening. Okay. That's it for optical aberrations for now. So now let's move on to digital. So once we've actually captured the light onto our sensor and we're working with all of them in the electronics, what can happen? So we've already talked about some of them. So posterization, for example, noise is a result of the sensor. So that's not exactly digital, but it's definitely a part of the sensor itself. Blooming is also an artifact that happens because of the sensor. If you have any questions about those, do feel free to let me know, but I feel like we'd be beating a dead horse in those cases. So we'll move on from those. We'll talk about aliasing. And so aliasing is basically when you take a very jagged edge and a digital edge where you can actually see each of these particular pixels. And aliasing is actually being able to view that block, so this stepwise motion or the stepwise change in a diagonal line. And so if we anti-alias something, then what we're doing is trying to smooth it out by doing a little bit of dithering or mixing some of these colors So rather than having a very sharp edge between this yellow and the blue, we have the yellow, and then we have slightly less yellow, slightly more blue, and slightly more blue, slightly less yellow, until we finally move to blue. And so the effect then is that we soften the edge of this particular circle here. So this looks more circular and less granular, but also we have lost definition on the edge of the circle. And so remember when we were talking about this low-pass filter before, I also called it an anti-alias filter. That's essentially what it's doing, is that it's blurring this edge a little bit so that the light that comes through, and remember that the context of this is for the Bayer color filter array, so that we don't get sort of strange Wira or other patterns that we'll talk about more in a second. And so we blur it just a little bit, and so we make it blurrier, which makes it nicer to look at perhaps, but at the expense of some of these details. So we don't, by anti-aliasing something, we are getting rid of what we call jaggies, or these jagged edges. Okay, but Moira is actually a big problem. So this is why we anti-alias in the first place. And I mentioned a couple of lectures ago how we can, because of Moira, get this really strange effect in very high resolution areas. And so I alluded to, but didn't show you the example of, a brick wall, where we are changing from the white mortar to the red brick to the white mortar very, very quickly. And if, when we are reconstructing this image, maybe via some demosaicing algorithm, or even if we shrink this image in Photoshop a little bit, all of a sudden the resolution of this is too high for the resolution of the image of what we are talking about. And so what we can get is this appearance of waves or just some sort of a strange pattern, because we have a misrepresentation in the number of pixels. So some pixels here, for example, there's too many pixels representing the white mortar and not enough representing the red brick. And then along this trough here, we have the opposite, too many pixels representing the red brick and not enough representing the mortar. And so as this changes, as the computer shrinks this in the case of this particular one, or as a computer is running its demosaicing algorithm in order to try to reconstruct some of these, some of the colors, it doesn't know what it's looking at. And so it's just basically an algorithm that's saying, okay, well, I'm going to put this much color here, that much color there, et cetera. And so we can get these sort of patterns that we don't expect or that we wouldn't see. And this isn't something that we would typically see in analog reconstruction of this. So basically the repetitive detail is too high for whatever it is. In this case, it's too high for the actual file size or for the actual dimensions of the photograph. But this is also true if the resolution exceeds or the detail here exceeds the resolution of your camera's sensor itself. And so I showed the example of the edge of this person's shoe and the denim jeans that happen as a result. We can get a combination of problems. So this Moira and this maze pattern that can happen because of the recombination of the colors from the demosaicing algorithm. And so you'll notice that these are both crops from particular images, and you can see this really strange maze pattern just because of the way that the algorithm is handling reconstructing all of these colors. And so here we even get some Moira in the colors. You can see that it goes from red to blue to red to blue, so on and so forth. We get this strange Moira and maze pattern with artifacts within these particular images. And so that's why we place this anti-alias filter on top of the sensors. It's to help, it's to make it a little bit softer, but it's also to help remove some of these very high frequency patterns that would confuse our sensor and be a problem in this way. So another thing that photographers like to do to fix this sort of softening that we have because of the anti-alias or the low-pass filter is to actually sharpen their images, just to give them a little bit more pop and maybe to give them the appearance that it was very well focused, for example, or a variety of other reasons. You'll see this is a very popular thing to do, is to apply some sort of sharp mask or apply some sort of sharpening to the photo. And so they might try to use sharpening, but if you do too much sharpening, you can actually get weird halos around your objects. And so the way that a computer tries to sharpen something is to find an edge. It tries to find an edge based on some gradient of color, and then tries to make that edge a little bit harsher by removing some of that softness. So it might make this side of the edge, for example, match better, or it might increase the contrast on each side of the edge. So it might make this side a bit darker, this side a bit lighter, but if it goes too far, it can make the inside edge black, for example, and the outside edge white. And so you then get this sort of weird sharpening halo. And this is sometimes prevalent when people like to over-sharpen their images when they are trying to regain some of the lost detail from their low-pass filter or because of their anti-alias filter. And so basically, to fix this, don't sharpen too much. Also use RAW. If you use the RAW format, you can use different demosaicing patterns from different software tools, and you might be able to help get sharper images in the first place. And so along those lines, or rather along the lines of file types, we also have, if you remember, this JPEG compression that we can have as a problem or as a result of the lossy JPEG algorithm. And so if you save a JPEG at 100% quality, it's going to be a slightly larger file, and it still is lossy, but it's going to retain almost all of the quality. We can essentially see no difference in quality in a 100% JPEG to the original image. However, that doesn't mean that you aren't losing data. You are. You are losing data, but we just can't perceive it very well at 100% quality. But at 10% quality, the compression artifacts of JPEG really become apparent, because you can see now sort of these blocks that JPEG uses to try to compress some of this data. We lose a lot of not only detail, but also some of the color detail that exists. We just lose a lot of resolution throughout this image as a whole. And so as we are compressing it, we are discarding color information, we're discarding some of the fine detail. And so when you're working on images, remember that you want to save in some sort of an uncompressed format, or keep your RAW file around before saving it as a JPEG, so that you can keep the original bits around as long as possible. Or if you don't have the option to use RAW, be sure to set your camera's JPEG processor, so there's usually an option telling your camera what sort of JPEGs to save. You should usually use the highest JPEG setting that you possibly can, just so that you are sure to retain as many bits as possible, as much detail as possible when working on an image. Okay, so I can't take much more of this heat. Thank you all for sitting through it. We'll see you next week when we have our lecture on even more software tools. Thank you very much for coming.